Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first Tour Daily in the Escape Collective. We're here. We're in Bilbao. We're at the Tour de France start. We're going to talk all about tomorrow's stage, the things we've seen over the last couple days. Who wants to set the scene for me?
I'll field this one.
Okay.
So we're sitting in a square very close to our apartment. We are surrounded by, on our right, a group of bikers on like 1970s kind of era, big sort of road limousine things.
Bikers with the motor type.
Honda Goldwing.
Motorbikes, yes.
Honda Goldwing bikes.
Honda Goldwings.
Yeah. Goldwings. And they arrived blasting music, and then pretty soon after that, one of them got a puncture, and then it was blasting air all over the square. Slightly behind them, we have a religious museum. Immediately behind me, we have a table of children just yelling.
Yelling.
By children, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to turn around. I don't want to get attacked, but... Yeah. We'll say like 18-year-olds.
Yeah.
Young enough to know better, old enough to not care. Or is it the other way around?
I think the other way around.
Okay. So that's where we are.
I should introduce everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. If you listen to our podcast the rest of the year, you'll hear me an awful lot. Joining me today, we've actually got a sizable crew for this first podcast. The crew is going to change throughout the rest of the month, but today... We've got, you just heard Ian Treloar. Ian,
hello.
You just landed from Australia via Hanoi earlier today.
I'm quite dazed and confused. I'm not sure if you're picking that up.
A little bit. Also joining me, Ronan McLaughlin. Ronan, you're only on for a couple days here, unfortunately.
Yeah, short tour for me this year. In and out of Bilbao, 4 or 5 days on the ground. Getting the tech, getting out of here.
Getting all kinds of good stuff. Johnny Long.
Hello, good to be back. Yeah, I just didn't want, like, it's awkward when you're taking a microphone off someone. I just didn't want to, my palms are slightly sweaty.
Like Eminem.
It's humid.
Knees weak.
Johnny's still in the middle of finishing a story, so he may duck out for about 15 minutes here and then show up later in the episode.
I'm going to interrupt Johnny for a second just to warn us all that it's happening again.
Uh-oh.
Where all the other people in the square are looking at the five guys with the microphones. Wondering what the hell are they at? Who are they talking to?
I feel like we need to like put our tour lanyards on so at least they could sort of put two and two together and figure out that we're not just...
I think they're expecting a rendition of Dos Cervezas, por favor.
We are a little way away from the center of where things are happening with the tour, so we do actually just look like five wankers with microphones sitting around a table.
Our special guest today... Josh Robinson from the Wall Street. Are you Josh or Joshua professionally?
The byline is Joshua, but to you guys, I'm whatever.
Just Josh.
Just Josh. Josh.
It is wicked to be able to be like, hi, I'm Joshua from the Wall Street Journal. I don't think we've ever acknowledged that before. Like that's probably top five things you can introduce yourself as.
I do it all the time.
You do?
Yeah.
It's one of the top five things I introduce myself as.
Josh, we have podcasted with you previously.
Yes, many times.
In a previous life, in a previous iteration, and always loved having you on. And frankly, we just love having you around at the Tour de France. We're gonna bring in your perspective as somebody who covers lots and lots of sports. For example, you are here for a couple of days, then you're going to Wimbledon, and then you're coming back, and then you're going to, what's after that? I can't remember.
Women's World Cup.
Women's
in
World
Australia,
Cup.
In Ian's country.
So a much sort of broader perspective than what we bring to these episodes. So what are these going to be? We're going to podcast every single day. We're going to sit around with these microphones every single day with whoever we have on the tour at that time, plus a whole bunch of special guests and other folks that we talk to. We're going to talk about the day's stage. We're going to talk about the next day's stage. We're going to talk about what we've seen on the ground. The idea is to bring you into the Tour de France. We think that we're incredibly lucky to be here at the tour. We love doing this job, and to give everybody out there a little taste of it is, I think, the best thing we can possibly do. So, with that in mind, fellas, it is Friday when we record this. It is the day before the tour kicks off. Yesterday, we saw the team presentation, we saw press conferences, we saw all sorts of interesting things. What has stood out so far in the last couple of days? Should we start with press cons?
Yeah, what stood out is the positivity and lightness of everything and everyone. I don't know what's, maybe it's something in the water here, or maybe it's Spain, maybe it's the Spainness of the tour that means that everyone's just chilled out. But it's been not stressful and quite fun and relaxed, which is quite disarming.
Really unusual. Yeah, even the riders feel like that. I mean, talk specifically about some of the stuff we saw in the press conference yesterday. Like, what makes you, what did you see there?
Mark Cavendish being human and engaging with us and his emotions about his final Tour de France. You know, getting caught up in the fact that his career's coming to an end and this will be his final 3 weeks around France. Then we had Tadej Pogacar, who's really stepped into his role as star cyclist and is borderline entertaining now with what he says, when previously he wouldn't say much. We even had Jonas Vingegaard of Jumbo Visma attempting to answer a question in a way that wasn't about his nutrition or his wife. So there's a lot of, like, I think the tour has collectively stacked a lot of W's early on.
What was that question?
So if we go in our way back machine, we have audio of this somewhere, but it's kind of bad audio. It's like recorded in an auditorium, so we'll just sort of paraphrase for you here. So Jonas Vingegaard was asked, I think by you actually, Johnny, what did you ask this question?
Andy McGraw.
Oh, it was Andy. Okay. Who will, I think, be on the pod at some point over the next month. He was asked roughly, what's it like going from being the hunter, which he was last year, to being the hunted? And yeah, his answer was good. He said, on one hand, you can say you're the hunted, but I'm also still hunting for victory. He like flipped it on us. As a non-native English speaker, it was actually quite a kind of impressive bit of language, I thought.
I mean, there was a massive opportunity there for him to divert to the nutrition answer, like hunted food.
Or to do a fish gag.
Sodium bicarb. There's any way he could have went there.
I'm more of a fisherman.
Do you have Jonas Vingegaard down as the most like Joe Rogan survivalist guy in the peloton? Because he would not, for me, he wouldn't be. I would go for more of a, who's the bearded guy in Total Energies, the one who did the lone breakaway? Do you remember him?
Matty Bergadu.
No, not Matty Bergadu.
Oh, Turgis?
Correct.
Turgis does have a beard.
He could survive in the wild for days.
There's just so much good facial hair.
Anthony
on
Perez?
Perez is the
best. Kofidis is his friend from the breakaways.
Yeah, there's more mustaches than normal this year.
Mustaches and goatees?
Yeah.
I'm glad that we're moving past the goatee era. I think we still have a few. We've got Alaphilippe and we've still got a few
Tom Pidcock.
On. Tom Pidcock? Yeah, but does he?
Well, that's a big question.
Nobody really knows.
No, but Jonas Vingegaard was borderline entertaining.
Yeah, Ian has just pulled up a photo of Anthony Turgi, and he's bearded.
Just on my desktop.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that I've got just sitting there for occasions such as these.
Vingegaard was good. However, I want to talk about some of the UAE Jumbo kind of vibe that's going on. And what we were talking about before we hit record, which is that a lot of the sort of Jumbo stuff happening feels quite like Sky 2013, 2014 at this point. Like they're the sort of the attitude towards the rest of the race. It's all these like small things. Like the thing that we kind of had picked up on, which we were, to be honest, slightly annoyed by, was that most of the teams were wearing the berets, the sort of like local Basque beret hat thing at the team presentation yesterday, and Jumbo decided that their team issue sponsor correct baseball caps was the thing that they were going to rock up on. And there's just like little things like that that sort of annoy us about this team at this moment.
We have been doing some reporting on this because it's a pretty important story, but just for some background, the regional hat that you are referring to is not a beret, Kaylee, it's a chapella.
Excuse me.
A traditional Basque garment.
I regret the error.
Originating in the 15th century. Anyway, so there were several teams, not just Jumbo-Visma, not wearing the chapella. But I would say that Jumbo-Visma were the ones most not wearing the chapella.
Yes.
It seemed very purposeful from them, whereas the others maybe just seemed like they didn't like it.
Yeah, it seemed like a team directive. Anyway, it was this really small moment, but there's been sort of they've been piling up, basically. And the team, I think, could use a bit of being a slightly more approachable. And again, I would have said the exact same thing about like Sky during most of their dominant years. And maybe it's just a function of where they exist, and maybe it's just a function of the fact that they're defending champions, and that's probably a stressful place to be. But they don't feel like they're connecting with fans in the same way that they should be.
And I think it's important to mention also, like, none of these things that they're doing you can actually criticize them for, because actually they're just being, you know, almost hyper professional. Like, they're
winning the bike race.
Yes. and what they're, you could argue what they're doing is, you know, in ensuring in every way possible that they have the best chance to perform. But still, Pogacar and UAE can be, well, Pogacar on his own probably, can be equally successful with a much more relaxed attitude.
I was just going to add that what's interesting also is that we know that in cycling, because compared to other sports, we know that more professionalism goes a much longer way in cycling, just because the delta between your top teams like a Jumbo and the sort of Pro Conti teams, like the gulf in professionalism between those is enormous, which is not something that exists in, like, you know, between the first team in the Premier League and the, like, 15th.
An interesting follow-up point on the Cipella, just to take it back to where we began. Yep. And I would say that, based on that, UAE Team Emirates are a team that seem like they are one of the more professional outfits. But you see with Tadej Pogacar that there is enough room there for somebody to have a legitimate personality of his own within a team dynamic that doesn't necessarily seem like it would allow that kind of thing to flourish. At the stage start, he was speaking in Basque to the fans. He was winning them over, saying Alpa Bilbao, Alpa Athletic, Gora Euskadi, whilst wearing a Cipella and looking extremely happy. If we were to rank the riders wearing that hat, he would be the most happy.
Going back to Josh's point then for a second, actually I would say there's maybe even a gulf between Jumbo and some of the, even this, like, maybe second, third, you know, I don't know how you would rank them, but just if you think of the top teams, even like the likes of the Ineos are probably level pegging, but then the next top team, whoever that is, there's probably even a gulf in some of the things that Jumbo-Visma are doing in terms of, you know, even the technical aspect of everything they're doing. You know, obviously you've got the wind tunnel test and you've got all that, but they're actually, nothing springing to mind right now, but I know quite a lot of things that they're doing that actually are, you know, I don't want to say light years ahead, but you know what I mean, of what some other teams are doing.
Yeah, how many teams are bringing their own mattresses, for instance? How many teams have an advanced squad that goes to hotels and installs air conditioning when they don't have it?
Remember when Sky used to do things like try to bring RVs to the Tour de France? Like, again, this is, it's giving me the same vibes. And the funny thing is that Sky, now Ineos, they just don't do this anymore? Like, it's... When you're not... Maybe when you don't have a chance of winning the Tour de France, you give up on that sort of thing, or has that program just sort of, I don't want to say fallen apart, that's a bit harsh, but
I don't know, I think that's been unfair to Ineos. I think they're actually doing, they're maybe just a bit less vocal about what they're doing now. I think they're, some of the work that Ineos are doing at the moment kind of boggles the mind also. When I sort of gate crashed the science and cycling conference yesterday, I'd planned to go to 2 days of it, but first of all, there was no press passes, and then an actual ticket for it is incredibly expensive and would also take up two of my 5 days on the ground of the tour. So it wasn't all that practical to go the whole thing. But actually, some of the presentations that happened there, which I hope to report on, sort of shine a light on some of the work that these teams are doing. And Jumbo and Ineos especially are very much leading the way. But then I had a comment from one insider from... one of these top teams, let's say Jumbo or Ineos, an insider at one of those two teams, who said, well, we kind of lead the way, and UAE then just use their money to copy us. So Ineos maybe just keeping a lot, their cards closer to their chest these days.
A time-worn tradition, though, is really what that is.
I was just going to say, it's not all the new things that Jumbo are doing that are maybe beneficial, because they've also painted their bus gold, emblazoned it with Ride Your Dreams, and are making AI versions of their riders. For what reason and what marketing to Ride Your Dreams, I'm not quite sure. Is that going to sell more Jumbos or Vismas?
No. There is a... Horror movies are a genre that people like.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So there is bound to be some portion of the cycling audience that likes being a little bit freaked out, and they're catering for them as well.
For anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, they released a AI version of Jonas Vingegaard.
As a small boy.
With an American accent. It was good stuff.
Isn't Jonas already an AI version of
Tour de France cyclist?
It was deep in the uncanny valley, and I did not enjoy it. I don't think anybody enjoyed it so much. I do want to move on, though, that was our sort of, that's our early impression of these teams. And I do think that that's relevant. Before we move on, I need to mention this very quickly. Escape Collective is a membership funded entity. That means that this podcast is funded by our members, which means if you're not a member, you're not currently funding this podcast in any way. That's okay, but we'd prefer if you headed over to escapecollective.com/join and signed up, because then you can feel good about listening to this podcast and you can drop the paywall on escapecollective.com. There's tons of great stories on there. We got stage previews every day. Ronan here right before the podcast published 2 stories in like 20 minutes. You're not going to get that stuff unless you are signed up.
They weren't both written in 20 minutes. They took my entire day to write those 2 pieces.
And then we published them in 20 minutes. Yes.
So what you're actually saying is that we are just bad at trickling out our content.
Yeah, we don't schedule things.
Yeah, right. Okay, cool. Right, sounds like something we need more members to help us rectify.
We need someone to pay for Google Calendar. That's what we really need. You should head over to escapecollective.com/join and sign up, because we're going to have a bunch of amazing content from the Tour de France. And frankly, if you're not signed up, you won't be able to read it all. And that'll be unfortunate for everybody. So please go do that. All right, let's move on to talking about tomorrow. So tomorrow, meaning Saturday, stage 1. Now, obviously, we did a big preview a week ago, myself and Dane Cash and Joe Lindsay. We have a bit more info on tomorrow's stage now. We also have heard all these press conferences. We've sort of seen for ourselves how confident various riders are. Tomorrow's stage is a very, very difficult stage across the Basque Country. I think it's over 3,000 meters of climbing, lots and lots of hills, including 2 pretty nasty ones in the final, 20 kilometers or so. The last climb is particularly nasty, and this is going to decide the yellow jersey on the first day.
Are you saying it's particularly nasty because of looking at the gradient, or because you went out and rode it today? How much does the bearing have on?
Well, Johnny, I did in fact. I got out for a little bike ride today with our friend and colleague Chris Marshall Bell. We went and rode the last 2 climbs, and I have a couple observations ahead of tomorrow's stage. First, the penultimate climb, the second to last climb. Not hard enough to make any massive difference, and there's a whole bunch of flat after it. I don't think it will do much other than sort of like tail off a bunch of riders who were never going to be in the finale anyway. The final climb is horrible. It's very Muir de Huy-like. It is incredibly steep. I think in theory it only gets to like 14 or 15%. It certainly felt like more than that to me. It's going to explode the front of the race, and I think it basically sits right at the sort of upper limit of somebody like Mathieu van der Poel, and probably sort of better suits, frankly, the riders that are looking at the GC in this race.
I think maybe the most interesting thing about tomorrow is just we're going to immediately get an idea of how well Pogacar has recovered from his injury in the Age Basque on the Age. And you know, you think of other tours, he would have had time to ride into it, and he would have had time to find his form. But we're going to know tomorrow how he's recovered from that injury. I suspect he's my favorite for the stage, and I have nothing to base that on other than the fact that he's Pogacar. But we're going to know this time tomorrow.
Yeah, it's an interesting finale. So we have this really, really steep climb. Like I said, sort of 14, 15%. The last 800 meters of it are just nasty. I mean, I was sitting, granted, I'm missing a couple hundred watts compared to these guys, but I was sitting in basically my lowest gear, cranking it over quite slowly, going as hard as I could, going up this thing. And then it turns right, and today it turned right into a headwind, which I think is relevant. I think that's the predominant wind direction, so I think that's likely to be the same tomorrow. Into a headwind, and then you kind of descend down this big, almost highway. I hit over 70 kilometers an hour solo, which means that any big group is going to hit 100, 110, maybe even faster. You drop back down into Bilbao. Oh, we have more motorcycles all showing up.
We appear to be in a biker bar.
I think we're at a biker bar. You drop back down into Bilbao on this sort of highway thing, and then it actually kicks up again up to the finish line. It's like a full kilometer of maybe sort of 6, 7, 8% up to the finish, and I think that kilometer is actually what's going to make the biggest difference, because with the right turn, with the headwind, with all the descending after that sort of steep kicker climb, I think it's probably a group of like 5 to 15 that kind of comes over that together. And then it basically comes down to who has a kick over 800 meters to 1K.
And yeah, like Pogacar may well make the front group tomorrow, but I think Pogacar on top form is hands down the favorite for that finale.
Yep.
But we don't know where he is right now.
Yeah, I think that the big question for me is whether some of the riders with a stronger kick than him can get over. So that basically comes down to Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert. If those two can get over it, then they will probably win that sort of final kick up.
Is the finish like that finish in Switzerland, was it last year, where Pogacar won ahead of Michael Matthews, bit of an uphill drag to the finish. Is it that sort of final kilometer, or...
It's
putting you on the spot
that.
Here.
It's steeper than that. Okay. Yeah. So I did the descent, and we stopped at a red light, and I looked to my left, and it was Philippe Gilbert on my left.
Philippe Gilbert?
Yep.
Philippe Gilbert?
I think he was out, like, doing stuff for Eurosport.
Philippe Gilbert.
I think he was out doing stuff for Eurosport or something. Anyway, he was kitted up. He's been riding. And so I turned to him and said, Philippe, like, what do you think? What do you think of the finale? And he just goes, oh, hard. So...
No shit, Sherlock.
No shit, Sherlock. Followed up with who you think's going to win, and he wouldn't give me a name. He would not give me a name, and then it light turned green, and we rode in different directions. But, yeah, even Philippe Gilbert, sort of king of the Ardennes, which I think is very similar to what this finish looks like, said a very, very, very difficult finish. Who's Philippe Gilbert?
It's Sean Kelly's version of Philippe Gilbert. I can't even say it now. Philippe Gilbert, yeah.
Philippe Gilbert. Yep. Well, he was impressed by the final climb. I guess I just want to impress on everybody out there that it's hard. Like, it's not just like a little bump that's going to take the peloton down to 50 riders. It's like, yeah, it is a serious, serious, very steep kick, and there will be gaps over the top of it. I do think it'll slightly come back together on the descent, but it's a hard one. So... The other thing that they did with stage one was they removed the bonus seconds.
Yeah, they revised it. So originally at the top of the Côte de Pike.
Yeah, that's the hard one.
The third category climb, there was bonus seconds of 8, 5, and 2 seconds for the first riders over. And then at the finish, there's always 10, 6, and 4. And what they realized is that the bonus seconds meant that a rider could win the stage and not get the first yellow jersey, because if... Say a rider goes over. I worked it out. It took me a long time to work all the ways it could work. But you can basically finish like second or third, and then also finish second or third. And if it's like a different guy who came first over the top of the climb and a different guy who won the stage, then there are different permutations.
And ASO wanted the first winner to wear the old jersey.
You need an Yves Lampaert type character to start bawling his eyes out saying, I'm just the son of a farmer. Otherwise, it's not the Tour de France.
It's amazing that they realized this between the printing of the road book and the start of the race.
Yeah.
I wonder who found it.
It takes a long time to kill that many trees, to be fair.
So that's the only other change. I don't think that changes much. They're still going to race for the top of that climb, like, it's the finish line, basically.
Well, in his press conference, Pogacar said that's 8 less seconds that I can win, which is just great sort of spin zoning his head. Like, I really appreciate how UAE have stepped up the mind games much that it irritated Wout van Aert a little bit at the press conference, because like the question was asked to Jonas about the mind games, but then Wout actually interceded and was like, I think it's just the mind games, like the other guy said. Well, why has he gone Toto Wolff? I don't know.
No, he referenced you, like your colleague.
Your colleague, yeah.
Because you would ask the question about it.
After a bust up last year, we're now friends. See, that's what I mean about the good vibes of the tour. Even the coldest of hearts can thaw.
Tadej did say that the legs are good, but the mentality is super good.
Super good. Super good. So, beyond tomorrow's stage, what are we thinking in terms of... who wins this Tour de France? Like, what are your takeaways from... I'm not asking for a prediction of the winner, but kind of continuing upon what you're talking about, the feeling we're getting off of these riders, the level of confidence that we're getting off these riders, some of the mind games that UAE is clearly playing, you know, pretending that Adam Yates is going to be a co-leader, blah, 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 blah. All these things are sort of diversionary tactics. Where are we feeling about the top two?
I feel like you could You could park the entire 22 team buses in the gulf that exists between Pagacha and Vingegaard and the rest of them.
Yeah.
And you were saying yesterday, actually, that you just really hope that nothing happens to one of the two. That means that they can't end up fighting it out for yellow the whole way through the race. Because if you lose one of them, then it just goes back to being like a 2010s tour where it's just like one dominant guy.
Yeah, it'll basically go back to the Dauphiné, where one of them will get 4.5 minutes ahead, decide that's enough, and then just defend it the rest of the time. Yeah. Right, and that'll be really unfortunate. So that's what we don't want to happen. As always, Pogacar feels a lot more kind of relaxed than Vingegaard. That's not really surprising, but can we take anything from that? Do we feel like the pressure that has been heaped upon Jumbo-Visma and heaped upon Jonas Vingegaard is going to affect them?
I mean, we have our answer already if you've watched On Chains. When the proverbial hits the fan, they don't seem to cope too well with that.
They mostly yell fuck and ask who needs a bike.
Yes. And everybody gets a bike, but nobody's on their own bike. Some people have multiple bikes.
Didn't affect Sky for all those years.
That's true.
Remember even the year, I want to say it's 2015, up the Alpe d'Huez on a Saturday, where Quintana took about a minute and a half back on Froome, and Wout Poels was just dragging Froome up the mountain. Even then, like, Froome was freaking out, but Wout Poels wasn't.
Very true, very true. Although Jumbo does not, again, we were kind of talking before about how they were Sky-ish, but it doesn't feel exactly the same to me. They feel like they're role-playing Sky.
They also do more things than Sky.
Like little 2013 Sky cosplay here.
The big difference, I think, this year, though, is going to be that they have a Tour win in the bag with Jonas last year. And again, if you've watched On Chains, it was incredible to see how much Pogacar was just in their heads. And I don't know if like Netflix clipped that up so that they mentioned Pogacar 4 times throughout the entire Tour de France, but Netflix made it look like they were talking about him night and day. But there was, you know, Planche de Belfi was in their heads, Pogacar was in their heads, UAE was in their heads. And I just wonder, maybe now having actually won a Tour, will that change their mindsets entirely?
Or does Pogacar do something in stage one just to rattle them?
Oh, 100% he's going to try to rattle them raw. If he is as fit as we think he might be, I think he goes over the top of the Côte de Pike alone. I don't think he stays alone, but I think he tries.
I love that call.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he can't help himself. Even if he didn't want to do it, he's going to try that, isn't he?
Last thing I want to talk about before we pop over to Jose Bain's culture section and a bit from the Giro Donne, which started today, I want to talk about Egan Bernal. So, Ronan, you just did a little piece on some power numbers that we didn't dig them out. He posted them on Strava. It's not like this is we didn't like hack his training.
No, we did. They were leaked to us.
Leaked
via
to us
Strava.
By Strava.
Via, not by. It wasn't by Strava. It's important to
explain why we were interested in this. I mean, the numbers like this are never going to be a full indication of what's going to happen in a bike race, but it looks certainly like he's ready. And I guess the reason this is interesting to me is because all of the communication from Ineos has been very sort of Pidcock-focused as of late. He won the stage last year, won the Alpe d'Huez stage last year. They've talked about him taking the next step. They sort of further define that as the next step means like potentially a run at GC, or at least to see how far he can go. They haven't really talked about Egan Bernal at all. The initial communication around Bernal was like, he's an old hand at the Tour, was literally the what Rod Ellingworth was saying before the race started. But I think he's a genuine contender for a top 10, a top 5. I mean, this is a guy who's won a Tour de France.
Yeah, I think the Pidcock thing is genuine also. Like, I've been saying it for a while that I think he is actually a GC rider in the making. You know, you just have to look at some of the riders that Ineos and Sky have turned into Tour de France champions down through the years. And you know, most of them are riders who, at the beginning of their career, didn't appear to be any way, shape, or form a GC rider. And you have, you know, Thomas and Wiggins and all the riders who started off on the track and then won the Tour de France. So if you consider that and then consider that Pidcock has started off his career and does already look like a potentially a GC rider, then presumably there's a lot that they can do there. And I expect that tilt to happen at some time, and no doubt this year is going to be the beginning of that. As for Bernal, I wrote a piece today looking at his final training ride, or not his final training ride, but one of the final sort of intense training rides that he did ahead of this year's tour. It was last Sunday as we're sitting here talking, and it was a 4-hour ride around where he lives in Monaco. Took in the Col d'Huez from a couple of different sides. Never actually did a full ascent of the Col d'Huez, so we don't have like a time check for that as a comparison. But what he did do was he just did a three distinct efforts within the session. One was like a sustained sort of steadier effort, which was nevertheless still pretty impressive. But then he did 2 10-minute over under efforts, as they're called, sort of above and just below threshold for 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off. And the numbers he was doing there, if the Google weight for Egan Bernal is anyway accurate, Google says he's about 60 kilos, and I know perhaps, you know, Google said isn't exactly the most accurate thing to be trying to judge Egan
that
Bernal's weight.
That's the eyeball test, though.
Yeah. I mean, it's in around that somewhere. But yeah, he was doing 480 watts for the 30 seconds on, followed by 30 seconds at 330 watts for 10 minutes. And he's done two of these within that climb. And those are, as I put in the article, the kind of numbers you would expect from a former Tour de France winner. But if we consider how far he has come, yep, and the accident that he had last year, I think it's, first of all, truly, you know, sensational, inspirational, remarkable, whatever you want to say, that he's already back at the Tour de France. This time last year, he hadn't even made a return to racing. But then that he's not only just back at the Tour de France, but he's actually back in with the kind of condition that seems like he may have, you know, potentially a top 10, maybe even a tilt at a stage win. The most important thing for me was that he's actually, you know, it's like the closing of the loop. He's back at the Tour de France as at least some, in some way, the Egan Bernal that we knew previously.
There's only 3 former winners in this race, and we've spent all year talking about 2 of them.
Yep, that's very true. No Chris Froome, obviously, snubbed for this tour. I guess, the reason we wanted to bring it up and the reason we read the story, I just love to see it, basically.
Yeah, I think we were getting a bit excited when we were looking through the file this morning and we were seeing the power numbers.
And we're like, whoa! But also, like, every time you see numbers from those type of riders, they're all astonishing. Mm. So, like, it's just varying degrees of astonishing is all it really is. And he could be, we're talking about 1-2% difference here that would make the difference between him being 4th at this year's tour and him being 15th at this year's tour, right? So it's impossible to say from a Strava file, yeah, he's ready to contend for the podium. That's an impossible thing.
The one thing I will say from that Strava file, there isn't another rider in the tour at 100-1 that can do two efforts like that.
We still haven't put that bet on. So now we really need to get a move on and do it.
Yeah.
I mean, 6.8 watts per kilo. Like, those are the numbers that you see, granted, usually calculated, so I always put a big asterisk next to those. But those are the type of numbers that you see in sort of key moments of the Tour de France, dropping pretty much everybody, right? And granted, this is, you know, had a rest day beforehand. It's not as hard as a tour stage. Hasn't been racing for the first 3 hours, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, they're good numbers, and I think we're happy to see good numbers at Egan Bernal. And I thought that he was just sort of coming here to ride. I think that's kind of the sense that we got from Ineos. And after seeing those, I think maybe he's coming here to just, yes, to ride, to see how far he can go. And I think that's farther than we think.
I hope you're right, because I think anything that can make the GC battle better than it was like last year was adding a third member in. Just that, yep, that chaos where it's not just like 2 people up against each other, just a third one to be like, okay, what? Because Geraint Thomas didn't provide that. But Egan Bernal is also a different sort of rider as well, you know? We are recording this podcast. Kayla, you said you wanted to record it outside of our Airbnb because it was a bit sad in there.
It was.
And we've managed to find the bar next to the motorbike convention of Bilbao. So we've started strong and we will go on.
All right, I think that's enough about Egan Bernal. It's enough about stage one. We're going to pop over to Jose Bain, who is providing daily updates on, well, frankly, things somewhat completely unrelated to the bike race that you should know from wherever we are.
Hello and welcome to daily blogs and podcast entries from me, Jose Bain. In the next month, I will tell you all about the history, the castles, the geology, the culture, the food, the people, and yes, also the cheese along the route of the Tour de France, homme and femme. A bit of couleur locale while you see the lush fields of sunflowers, the beautiful mountains, and the pretty little villages. We start the Tour de France in Bilbao, in the Basque Country. Bilbon hasiko de Frantziako Tura is what the Basques would say, or my interpretation of it. Around one third of the population speaks the language, most of them in the Spanish Basque Country, or Euskadi, but also across the border in France they speak Basque. The seven regions that speak Basque, four in Spain and three in France together, are called the Euskal Herria. Euskara is a genetically isolated language. In other words, it is related to no other known language family. And as often happens with languages that cannot be linked to any other language group, a number of hypotheses have been put forward over the centuries to explain the origin of Basque. The only plausible theory to date establishes a genetic relationship between Euskara and the Aquitaine language spoken in the south of France. But I have also read theories that Neolithic cave dwellers in Altamira and Lascaux spoke a language of which the current Basque is a direct descendant. Well, I do not aim to have a scientific linguistic study here for you, so I also have no idea. But the linguist Luis Michelena said, "The real mystery in the history of the Basque language is not its origin, but its survival to the present day." During the reign of the Spanish dictator Franco from 1939 to 1975, regional languages, including Basque, were severely oppressed. It was even stripped of its official status in Spain, but it bounced back as it had done hundreds and hundreds of years. After the long years of contempt and disdain for the language by the Franco dictatorship, in the late 1960s, Euskara became the soul of the Basque nation. Ikastolas, primary and secondary schools taught in Basque, and Gau Escolas, our adult evening classes, played a vital role in reviving the language. The Gau Escolas were the precursor to the Euskaltegis, where some 40,000 adults study Basque today. The language thrives and more people learn and speak Basque on a daily basis. All signs in traffic are also bilingual, with some place names in Basque being so different to their Spanish and French counterparts on your Google Maps. Driving or riding around the country can be confusing. The longest name in the whole of Spain and the second in Europe, you know, after that one in Wales, is in the Basque Country. And although I'm known as a commentator for pronouncing rider and place names in a couple of languages, and I'm not even faced by an Asier Estebaria, Peo Goicoechea, or Jokin Elarrarte, I will not even attempt this one. Oh well, okay then, so you can all have a laugh. Aspiliqueta garaiko sarroyaren berekolarea. It means, or so the internet tells me, the low field of a high pen of Aspiliqueta.
Thank you, Jose, for those. Final thing today, the Giro d'Italia started this morning. Well, it kind of started this morning. They started it, and then the stage was canceled, and it was dumping rain, and it was a time trial, and lots of people crashed. And, well, I'll just let Abby Mickey step in here and tell you all about it.
Hello, and welcome to the Wheel Talk Podcast daily coverage of the Giro d'Italia. My name is Abby Mickey, and I am joined by the one and only Hannah Barnes. Hannah, hello.
Hello. This is the first time I worked out in 7 years that I'm not in Italy in the first week of July, so good to be here in different capacity.
Yeah, still focused on the Giro, but definitely in a different way. And you're currently riding for Uno X, but not, as you said, not at the Giro. So we're really excited to get your takes for post-race analysis on how things are going. And today we were going to talk about the first stage, but it has been canceled due to heavy rain. I think there are still some things that we can talk about. One, I just love the debate. Is it a time trial? Is it a prologue? Technically, it's a time trial, but it's like 400 meters longer than a prologue.
Yeah. I mean, the Giro, I think we've started with a prologue quite a lot over the years. I've done a lot of short ones there. But I mean, it's a chance for the time trial national champs to get their new skin suits out. So
that's true. I mean, last year it was only 300 meters longer than this year's one, and I feel like it still did some interesting things to the race. I mean, you had the jersey change hands in the first couple of days because of it, which was pretty cool, and like a good opportunity for the track riders to kind of show their strength on the road.
Yeah, I mean, we've had it quite a few years where it's been a team time trial, the first stage, which it doesn't always play into some teams and GC riders' hands. So there's probably quite a lot of the GC riders that are pleased that it's just their individual efforts that's gonna play the part today.
Mm-hmm. But not today.
No, unfortunately.
Not today, because when the stage was paused due to heavy rain, and we mean heavy rain, they're like, head on over to escapecollective.com, and I did a write-up on the stage and the cancellation, and the roads were basically just like covered in water, and there were parts of the roads that were also really muddy because mud had kind of slid off of the sides of the roads and onto the road. So it was really horrible conditions, but we still had a bunch of riders go. 87 riders still to start when the call was made that the stage would be canceled. So there was still some interesting things that happened. There's definitely still some things to talk about. But as far as that first stage, poor Tilda, her call that Chloe Dygert was going to take the jersey today and hold it all the way to the end, not so much. Little bit less hope for Chloe to win the Giro, but still not done. It's not over yet. Should we talk about the riders that did get to race?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's interesting because, I mean, I haven't seen the weather forecast. But clearly Movistar and potentially Jumbo-Visma and maybe FDJ as well, and with Chloe at Canyon, they must have looked at the weather forecast and put those riders going off early because they've already finished. Unfortunately, now they've technically got a disadvantage because they've done that full gas effort, 5-minute effort, and it's come to no nothing. But yeah, they must have prepared for that when they were putting the riders in for the start list.
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned that, actually, Hannah. I have some audio diaries from riders on the ground, and Nina Kessler of Jayco Lula mentioned a bit about how her team decided where to put the riders.
Well, that was day one. Yeah, that started pretty weird. We knew that the weather was pretty unpredictable and that it could rain or maybe not. So we checked like all the weather apps, and with everybody it was like something else. And so if a stage race starts with a time trial, the DS can choose the order. So I was like almost one of the last one. So when it started already like raining, and then it started thunder, and then we heard that girls were crashing, and so then they cancelled it for a bit. And that's weird, I think I never had this before in a race where you're like warming up and then don't know like when to take your like final gel or when to start your warm-up so it was pretty weird. But yeah, I think in the end it's good that they like canceled it, but I don't think there's like a good thing you could do today. Like, it was dangerous, but it's also like sad for the girls that did race. And also when they canceled it the first time, you know, girls already like finished in like really shit conditions, and then they are waiting to good conditions. So yeah, when is it fair? And well, it's really sad for my team. And actually, Letizia, she was like standing first. So yeah, she was a bit disappointed, of course, that I canceled it. And she did amazing, even in this like crazy weather. But yeah, that's cycling, and I think they choose for like safety, and so actually the race starts tomorrow and not today. Pretty weird, but it is how it is. Let's hope on some better weather tomorrow, and we're gonna make a good race tomorrow, and let's show how strong we are, because the girls that did ride today for my team, they did really good. Well, I didn't start yet. I started my warm-up, but and then I did my cool-down. So, but let's see how it goes tomorrow. And I hope the weather is going to be good.
How much damage does a five-minute effort do, though, if we're talking about like how this will play into the rest of the race? I imagine like it's maybe not ideal, but it probably isn't going to make a massive difference.
No, I think for some people it's pretty good to have that opener. Because it's hard. I think there'll probably be some riders that are still going to try and just do some sort of openers on the trainer, even though it's been cancelled, just to get their body and their heart rate up for tomorrow's stage.
Like you said, a lot of the GC favorites already did get to actually race before they cancelled the stage. Like Annemiek van Vleuten was second provincially on the start on the finish line before they canceled the stage, behind Letizia Paternoster, which is an awesome, it would have been a super awesome result for her if the stage had ended with the same top three that there was before it was canceled. Letizia obviously being a really, really decorated track cyclist who races for Jayco Lula and hasn't really done a ton on the road in the last couple years. She was riding with Trek Segafredo. She's won stage of the Tour Down Under with them and been a key part of their program from its beginning. But this year recently she's swapped teams, and now this would have been a massive result for her.
Yeah, she's had a pretty slow start to the season. When I looked at that, I was just following just the results coming in, and I saw that she was leading at the moment, and I thought that was actually pretty cool. I was happy for her. But when I actually had a look at the stage and I saw it and I saw the length of it, I knew that there's a lot of track races that would have really liked the look of it. And you can see that. I mean, I've only got the top 20 here, but probably half of those are from the track. So yeah, that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, Georgia Baker was Gracie Alvin's call for today, and she was sitting in sixth, but she also got like some of the worst weather because it was paused right after she came through.
Yeah,
so definitely. And like for Chloe Dygart, who's also obviously a track rider but targeting the GC at this race, the weather would have been a massive impact on her because she doesn't have a ton of experience on the road.
Turns out Chloe Dygart doesn't really hold back. She goes into every race and just wants to send it. So yeah, hopefully she's okay carrying on into the next stages, and yeah, heal up quick. But just looking at that, it just looked like the roads are just like ice out there. So good call from the organizers, and yeah, hopefully tomorrow the sun will be shining for the girls. You're better off losing 2 seconds in a prologue like this instead of potentially sliding out on one of those corners. So
tomorrow will be really interesting. I was looking at tomorrow thinking, oh, I think this is like a reduced bunch day. But now that there is no pink jersey handed out yet, what do you think that will do for tomorrow's stage?
I mean, it's the pink jersey. So yeah, it's the sprinters that probably didn't really think that they would have a chance to get the jersey. It's the pink jersey. Everyone wants to hold that. So I think tomorrow's stage is going to be crucial. There'll be riders that would have been going into tomorrow's stage thinking they were about 10 seconds down potentially. And now they're all on level playing field again. So yeah, it's going to be a good stage.
Yeah. And I mean, Lorena Wiebes in the peloton, it's like hard to see past her whenever there's a possibility of a sprint.
Yeah. Yeah.
We also got to hear from Loretta Hansen of Trek Segafredo, who did actually get to race. So let's hear from Loretta.
Hi, everyone. This is Loretta Hansen from Little Trek, and I'm currently in Chianciano Terme in Italy for the start of the Giro d'Italia. And over the next 10 days, I'm going to try and keep an audio diary to give you guys a bit of an insight into what it's like, what the racing's like here, and life on the road in Italy. So, yeah, I guess today, stage one, we have the prologue. It's 4.4 k's long. It's obviously quite fast. There's a couple of little drags in it, a sort of technical little descent. And yeah, it's going to be a bit of fun. There's potentially some rain predicted in the afternoon. So yeah, it could be a bit of a luck of the draw of your starting time, whether you get rain or not. And then that could have a big impact on finish times. But yeah, we have Gaia Realini as first off. So yeah, we're excited to get underway here with the racing. Like, there's a lot of excitement around the race in general. You know, there was a little bit of anxiety, I think, as to whether we were actually going to be racing. You know, but it's exciting to be here. And then, of course, for us, as our first race as Little Trek, it was quite fun showing up at the presentation last night with everyone looking and checking out our new kit. Like, we're all really excited to represent a new brand and yeah, make some big goals and big changes for the future. So yeah, we're all here, ready, excited, looking forward to racing, and yeah, it's going to be a good Giro. There's some really tough stages, no real mountaintop finishes. So yeah, it's going to be a good tour. We've got a good team here, and yeah, a strong field in general. So it's going to be a good 10 days in Italy, and yeah, really looking forward to it. Lots of pasta, lots of good coffee, and hopefully lots of good memories. So yeah, I'll keep you updated as we go along, and yeah, look forward to sharing some stories. So we're just in the car on the way back from the prologue. At Giro, you never know what you're going to get, and today was exactly that. Gaia, what did you think of the weather today?
Today, rain, cat and dogs.
Yeah, it was a little bit chaotic. We had hail, super heavy rain, and it all started 2 minutes into the prologue, so not even the first rider had a dry ride. They delayed us for a little while when we had really heavy rain and some flash flooding, and then they started again, and then it dried for a little bit, but again, the rain came again, and it was just too much. Like, there was a lot of water on the road, so in the end they decided it wasn't safe, and yeah, they cancelled the stage. So I guess we all start tomorrow on the same time, and yeah, we go from there. But I think everyone felt okay today, and we're looking forward to the real start tomorrow.
All right, well, Hannah and I will be back tomorrow to talk about the second stage. First stage, pretty dramatic, but in the end, anticlimactic. And yeah, but there'll be more. We have a lot to talk about this week. Hannah, thanks so much for jumping on this call with me.
Pleasure.
Me and Ian have just watched a decimal child chasing a pigeon and then spitting water out of his mouth at the pigeon. It was fantastic. And if that's how this whole thing's kicking off, then I've got no complaints. No notes.
As an owner of two small children, I empathise with the parents in this situation, because I can easily imagine that kind of thing happening. But yeah, it was like a full mouthful, like projectile, not vomit because it was just spit, but just like a real gusher of water.
Projectile lemonade.
Yeah, it was really well executed, actually.
Did it hit the pigeon?
No, I missed it. The pigeon flew away. But never before I'd seen that, I'd never considered doing it. Now all I kind of want to do for the rest of the evening is maybe run after a pigeon.
That can be our little tour challenge that we set ourselves.
Yeah, instead of cricket on the first rest day, just...
just spit on pigeons.
Yeah, just get press officers and journalists to gobble on pigeons.
Does Escape have bail money?
I don't think pigeons press charges.
It's fine. The police here wear red berets. We're not getting arrested.
All right. I think it's time for us to wrap up today. Quick reminder, Escape Collective is brand new. And that means that we're still trying to reach as many people as we possibly can. So the best thing you can do, if you like this podcast, if you like our stories, if you like reading the website, share stuff. Share stuff this month. Share this podcast with friends that are maybe getting into the tour. If you've got friends who are literally just getting into the tour, we just wrote a story, actually, called How the Tour de France Works. Go check that one out. Share that story. If you find something good, share it. That'd be awesome. Because, yeah, like, to be quite blunt, we started with brand new social media accounts, brand new Facebook, brand new Twitter. Google doesn't really know who we are yet. Things like that. It's hard for us to get the word out there, and we're mostly reliant on you, on just the people out there sharing our stuff. Organic sharing is how a lot of our work finds its way to new eyeballs. So share stuff.
A video of us spouting water onto pigeons would move the dial on social media is all I'm going to say. That would work. That would short track all of our problems.
That is also a way of organic sharing.
That is organic. Everything about it is organic.
That seems like a great place to cut it off. We will be back tomorrow from the first stage of the 2023 Tour de France. Thanks for listening, everybody. Hasta mañana.